as for the music, it was really interesting with Led Zeppelin. I have 20,000 vinyl albums in my collection.
Wow.
And when this book was offered to me, I did not have a single Led Zeppelin album. And if you would ask me to name any of their songs, I might have been able to name Stairway to Heaven and Whole Lotta Love.
Can you imagine that? 20,000 albums and not one Led Zeppelin album. Welcome to Rock Conversations. I'm Rob Bob, and that is author Bob Spitz, whose new book, Led Zeppelin, The Biography, is fascinating. We'll talk about that more in just a little bit. Do you remember the first time you bought a Zeppelin album? I will confess, I do not have 20,000 albums, and I only own one Led Zeppelin album. I think I own one on CD. I own Zeppelin 2 on CD. But my vinyl, my one vinyl Zeppelin album is Led Zeppelin 3. And I can remember I bought it shortly after I started working my first real job at Midtown Foods in Winona, Minnesota. So I saved up however little you can save working part-time at $3.35 an hour. I'm kind of dating myself now, aren't I? Saved up some money, went down with a buddy to La Crosse, Wisconsin, you know, about 30 minutes from Winona. They sometimes had better record stores, not always. And I bought Led Zeppelin 3. And what I was really looking for, I didn't know the name of the song at the time, but there was one specific song I was looking for. So I got home. This is why I remember the album so well. I went track by track. You know, you drop the needle on each track and you're just waiting. I want to hear that guitar riff that I'm familiar with, acoustic guitar riff. I go through all side one. It's not there. Okay. Flip it over. Go through all side two. Nowhere to be heard. Little did I know at the time that the song I was seeking was Over the Hills and Far Away. That came on a later album. Oh, the woes. Woe is me, right? But I do love Led Zeppelin 3. It might even be my favorite Zeppelin album for its variety, for the fact that they, you know, they went acoustic on a couple tunes. 4 is great. You know, it's got all the punches. But 3 is so unique. It might be a toss-up, 3 versus 4. Anyway, Bob Spitz makes history today. He becomes the first guest to appear twice on Rock Conversations. So we will call this, in honor of Led Zeppelin, we will call this Bob Spitz 2. And let's get to our Rock Conversation with Bob.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back again.
To paraphrase or to quote Julie Andrews, let's start at the very beginning, a very good place to start. With your prologue, normally I read books and I look at the foreword of the prologue and think, okay, this kind of sets it up and it's all right. Your prologue is fascinating. I don't want you to mention the person's name you're referring to. In the radio business, we call this a tease. We'll let the listeners know at the end of the interview. But you set up a great basis for the book, January 1969. I want you to take it from there. One guy's hitchhiking from New York to Boston.
Right. It's a blustery Sunday afternoon. He is a young rock and roller. He has a band that's just getting off the ground, and he has heard about this incredible new band called Led Zeppelin with Jimmy Page as its lead guitarist. And so he's got to go. He has to see them. And he takes several cars along the way. He's hitchhiking up from New York to Boston. Arrives at a little club, and he knows the guy who's humping the equipment in for the band, and he worms his way in, and he sits at the back of the hall while the band is playing, and it's one of the earliest gigs that Led Zeppelin ever did. In fact, they claim one of the most important gigs they ever played in their career, and this young guy has an epiphany. He hears the future of rock and roll right there. And he breaks into tears that he's so moved. And of course, I won't tell you who it is, but it's somebody who turns out to be pretty damn famous later on.
That is correct. What's really interesting about that prologue as it pertains to our podcast, Rock Conversations, is, as you know, we interview, among others, DJs from the halcyon days of FM radio, 70s, 80s, a little beyond once in a while. You mentioned a couple of those great DJs and radio stations, WNEW in New York, Scott Muni, And then there was this guy who we came to know later nationally on television, who was a DJ at WBCN.
Right. J.J. Jackson. And in fact, he was there that night. He didn't introduce the band, but he was there at the club, really became quite friendly with them, and appears later on in the book, almost at the end of their career, when he comes to see them at one of the last gigs they ever played. This was such a critical time for rock and roll, because FM radio had just burst wide open onto the scene. And for young bands like Led Zeppelin, who had just put an album out maybe only a week or two before, this was a place for them to be heard. I mean, they couldn't play across the country yet. They couldn't get the gigs they wanted. But as long as you got airplay and those great stations, those wonderful early progressive stations played your record, you could become a sensation overnight. And that's what happened to Led Zeppelin. They arrived in Boston. The album had only been out a week. And sure enough, there are lines around the block, because not only Scott in New York, Scott Muni, but WBCN in Boston had been playing them all weekend. And so the fans had to see them for themselves. It was a wonderful time for rock and roll musicians, new bands.
You also note at different points in the book that Zeppelin, namely, I think Jimmy Page, was very, shall we say, reluctant to release a shortened single version that AM radio could play, and downright refused to release Stairway to Heaven as a quote unquote single. And so without these FM stations, they may not have caught on the way they did.
Yeah, perhaps not. I mean, Atlantic Records, who distributed Led Zeppelin's albums at the very beginning, they demanded singles. I mean, there was a pattern to releasing a new album. You released the new album, about a week later, you released the hot single from it, whatever it was. And so in addition to all the FM stations, the thousands of AM stations would jump on it. But Peter Grant, the manager of Led Zeppelin, who decided that if the kids were really into this, they would buy the album. Why sell a single? Why not, you know, if you're getting the airplay on FM stations, go for the album sales. And, you know, it was heresy at the beginning. The Atlantic Records was pulling their hair out trying to get them to release a single. But in fact, Peter turned out to be right. They sold millions of more albums because the kids couldn't buy the singles. They went out and they had to buy the album if they wanted to hear the rest of it.
It makes total sense. And, you know, his business intuition, along with his personality, served the band well, as you note, particularly not just with buying the albums, but when it came to getting rid of the middleman to promote concerts and kind of going to that 90%, 10% mix.
Right. He was actually the second person to do that. The Who had done it earlier. But there again, you know, it was considered heresy to demand that much money. There had been a split between the promoters and bands that went back 20 years. And that was very simply the promoter put up all the money and the promoter did all the advertising. And for that, he got it was a 60-40 split, 60 to the promoter, 40 for the band. Peter Grant changed that completely, demanding 90%, saying to these promoters, hey, listen, 10% of Led Zeppelin is a wonderful piece. You don't have to put up any of the money. All the word of mouth would bring people in. And he was right in that respect. Well, he made millions of dollars more for his band than they would have gotten otherwise.
We are talking with author Bob Spitz, whose new book is simply entitled Led Zeppelin, the Biography. It's a fantastic read, and I highly recommend that you check it out. Let's talk about a little of how Led Zeppelin came together. And there was almost a north-south divide, if you will. A couple of the members coming from the south, two other members coming from the north.
Right, exactly right. John Paul Jones and Jimmy Page lived within bedroom communities of London, and they had worked in London for years as session musicians. Robert Plant and John Bonham were from the Midlands. Not just from the Midlands, they had a different sensibility and they spoke even a different dialect. It was kind of their own patois. And there was a north-south divide. The people from the south, the Londoners, they looked down on people from the north. When John Bonham and Robert Plant walked into the first rehearsal for the band, they had never even met these guys before. I mean, it was incredible. It was almost like the way the Monkees were put together. Jimmy Page chose one from column A, one from column B, guys who had never played together, threw them in a room, and there was the band.
Throughout the book, I mean, these are four incredible musicians, four very intriguing individuals. But John Bonham, dare I say, seems to be at times, maybe more than at times, the most colorful. And I found it very almost humorous that if I read it right, he didn't have a phone and they wanted to reach him and to get him to join the band and had trouble even contacting him.
Yeah, they had to send like 30 telegrams to different places that he was playing in or pubs that he hung out in or girlfriends that he had known. Just to reach him to make contact. You know, he lived very simply. He lived in what they call a caravan, which we know as a trailer, behind his parents' convenience store. And so, he was hard to reach. It was a different time. You know, nobody had cell phones. And even Robert Plant was difficult to reach. And when he got that telegram from Peter Grant saying, we'd like you to consider joining the Yardbirds, you know, he thought it was a prank and he threw it away. So it took some time getting in touch with these guys.
Good thing he was able to get reconnected and reconsider.
Right.
What blows me away, either I didn't know it or I knew it and forgot, but you bring it up repeatedly in your book, is how often Zeppelin toured, particularly America, and how quickly they recorded those first four albums.
Yeah, they were recorded in about a year and a half. I mean, you know, it was lightning speed. And they were over here in America because they just couldn't catch on in the UK. One of the problems there, of course, was there were fewer places to play. There were pubs where a lot of the bands played and a few clubs, but they didn't have the kind of arenas that Led Zeppelin was looking for over here. And as soon as they got to America, they were playing in 5,000-7,000 foot seat arenas, and they made some money. So they were over here all the time. And it sowed some bad feelings among their fans in the UK as well.
So let's talk a little bit about your research and your writing process. I don't want to get too, as they say, inside baseball, but I'm very curious to know, when you delve into a book like this, do you ever get tired of the subject matter? And do you listen to the music as you're writing? And do you get tired of the music?
Yeah, I'll answer the first part of that first. You know, every one of my projects is about 5 years. The Beatles took 8.5 years. I absolutely love getting involved in it. I mean, it's such a luxury to be able to immerse yourself in someone's life and getting lost in it for such a long period of time. And over the course of that time, with all the research that you do, you come to know these people in a way that, you know, few people come to know them. I mean, even the closest people don't know that much about them because I hear from every kind of source all information that I can knit together to form a profile of these guys. As for the music, it was really interesting with Led Zeppelin. I have 20,000 vinyl albums in my collection.
Wow.
And when this book was offered to me, I did not have a single Led Zeppelin album. And if you would ask me to name any of their songs, I might have been able to name Stairway to Heaven and Whole Lot of Love. But that's it. I
knew
nothing else. During that time, Rob, I was on the road with Bruce Springsteen and Elton John. You know, it was a different kind of music. Our paths didn't cross. You know, there were no dates that we played together, no festivals we played together. And so their music just, it escaped me. And also my sensibility comes from, I hate to say it, the 60s music, you know, Dylan and Crosby, Stills and Nash and James Taylor and Joni Mitchell. And so I was still of that, what Led Zeppelin called the older passé generation, that they felt was obsolete. So when this was offered to me, at first I took a big gulp thinking, how do you write a book about a band and you don't know their music? And then I realized that I was absolutely the perfect person to do this. I was an empty vessel. I came with no preconceived notions whatsoever. And as a musician myself, I knew that I could sit down and let them just fill me up and that I would be able to understand their music by listening over and over and over again in a way I'd never heard it before. Also, I'll tell you that just so that I was sure that I would latch on to the right aspects of their music, to understand how John Bonham played drums, I got Carmine Appice, who was the drummer for Vanilla Fudge, to sit with me and explained how this guy was able to play those magnificent fills that he played. And I get Jeff Beck to explain, you know, Jimmy's guitar, yeah, and what John Paul was doing. So I, you know, as a biographer and a musician, you just look for these sources that can really put it all the pieces together for you. And then you have to say to yourself, take it slow, you know, ease into it slowly, really learn it, listen to it the right way, and try to interpret it for your readers, not just in a musical way, but in an entertaining way as well.
So all that said, do you have a unfair question, but I've been known to ask them, do you have a favorite Zeppelin album?
Oh, it's not so much the albums. I have favorite songs.
Okay.
Kashmir, definitely, I think it is magnificent.
Yeah.
Robert brought something to it that he really never brought to the other songs. The poetry, the experience of being in Morocco with Jimmy Page. I do love LZ4. I promised my wife after this book was over, I would never play Stairway to Heaven again, ever.
Have you lived up to that promise?
Oh, not really, because I've become quite friendly with Ann Wilson. And that version that Hart did at the Kennedy Center tribute, right.
Yep.
Even my wife will let me play that over and over. So LZ4, I thought, was really a watershed album. And I really was able to put myself in the rehearsals with them as they were putting that album together and recording it, not just recording it, but rehearsing it for a couple of weeks in a house in the Midlands, so that it really, it crept into my psyche.
So let's talk about it. Perfect segue. We'll talk a little bit about Four. I'm reading from your book here, quote, yeah, from Jimmy Page. We were like a marriage, like Lennon and McCartney. Now to Bob Spitz. Not quite. But they were about to embark on their most intricate creative endeavor. And it really was fascinating. But so unique to me was the fact that they didn't really go into, I hope I'm not screwing this up, you'll correct me, I'm sure, but they didn't just go into one studio or it was engineered in America. They brought it back to Britain, didn't like it. In some ways, it was a brilliant creative masterpiece. In other ways, from a recording standpoint, it was a mess at times.
Well, yes. I mean, they kind of put it together and rehearsed it at a place called Headley Grange. It was this old dilapidated manor house in about 100 miles from London. And they had been there before. It was a place they could go and just move in and live together and let the songs come out organically, which they did. They wrote them while they were there. Some of the songs they just created while the tape was running. And they had the Rolling Stones remote wagon recording studio out in the back. But then, of course, you know, Jimmy loved to tinker. So after he was done with the tapes, they would record in London again. They would do overdubs. They did it at Island Studios in London. And then he took the album to America to mix And that was just a mess because what he heard over the speakers in America didn't really translate to the speakers and the systems in the UK. And when he got it back here, it was really muddy and they had to mix it all over again. So could it have been simpler? Yep. But we got that kind of brilliant album from them. And if that's what it took, that's what it took.
On Rock Conversations, we are conversing with Bob Spitz, the author of the brand new book, Led Zeppelin, the biography. Let's dish some dirt here. Get a little ways away from the music because, you know, no Led Zeppelin interview is complete, just like no book is complete without some of the antics that followed them. I think it's probably fair to say that in the 1970s, Zeppelin was a band made for L.A. and L.A. was a city made for Zeppelin. Tell us about the Hyatt House.
Well, yeah, the Hyatt House. Actually, I had stayed there when we were selling Bruce Springsteen's album. Around record companies always stayed there because it was right smack dab in one of the best places on Sunset Boulevard. It was a, I believe it was a 14-story hotel. And until Led Zeppelin got there, it was called the Hyatt House, the Continental Hyatt House. But after Led Zeppelin left that first time, it became dubbed the Riot House, and it is the Riot House ever after. In fact, it's changed hands a couple of times, but I drove by it about a month ago, and sure enough, there was a sign out there, the Riot House. they've adapted it. But, you know, Led Zeppelin just decided they were going to take over this joint. They walked in the first time. These were, you know, young 21, 24-year-old boys from the UK. They came from this kind of, you know, gray, rainy environment to paradise. Not just the weather was gorgeous and the palm trees were flowing in the gentle breeze, but, you know, there were cars polished to the high gloss of a surfboard and convertibles and girls, you know, these guys, you know, they couldn't believe their eyes. Jimmy had been there before, but none of the others had. And they were like little kids in a candy shop. They could not wait to dive in. And they gorged themselves silly. The behavior, you know, Led Zeppelin changed the behavior on the road for rock bands. Not for better, but it's definitely part of the story. And I decided that you would get a good taste of it in the book.
As you were doing your research, were there one or two incidents you were previously unaware of that really jumped out? When I say incidents, I'm, you know, like away from the music, you know, behavior at a hotel or on the Sunset Strip, something like that?
There are some in the book that I will share with you in a moment, but I will also tell you that there were some others that were just too bizarre to include in the book. And, you know, you have to sit and make a judgment at a certain point, whether or not it's overkill to put every last story in, and whether we need to know something that is so personal and so kind of bizarre that it just takes over the story. And I decided not to in a few cases. But, you know, there was a lot of bad behavior. There was a lot of groupie action. I didn't realize that they had hung guys by their heels from the ninth floor balcony and that Peter Grant had handcuffed women to the pipes of a hotel bathroom for a weekend. Those things were incredibly disturbing. I think the way these guys treated women, you know, I have enormous respect for women and my wife especially, and I'm the father of a daughter. So a lot of the behavior gave me pause. People write it off saying, oh, these were impetuous guys on the rock bands on the road, and the girls threw themselves at them. But my wife also cautioned me not to call these groupies young women. A lot of them were 14, and I will tell you, some 12 years old. And she said, these were girls way below the age of consent. And, you know, it you get the good and the bad in this book. You have to make up your own mind. But I tried to concentrate on the music as much as possible.
Did they really have a motorcycle that they rode up and down the hallway on the ninth floor?
Yeah, on Bonzo's 25th birthday, somebody gifted him a motorcycle, and they rode it up and down the carpets. I mean, you know, look, they did things like that. They also sailed champagne bottles out the window at cars, and in one case, took apart a piano and sailed it out the window as well. You know,
different time, like you say. Yeah, different time, different era. Yeah. Here's another one that I had either forgotten or maybe never knew or realized just how young these boys were, you know, early 20s. And can you imagine, I can't, having that success and everything thrown at you. Let's talk a little bit more specifically about John Bonham, Bonzo. I thought it before I read your book, and I think of it even more, that he was, I don't want to say a tragic figure, but he was like this huge teddy bear. That's kind of the image that I conjured in my head. You know, on one hand, an incredible musician. On the other hand, you know, just a drunk and a mean one at times. And in between was this guy who got homesick. You know, he's taking advantage of all the perks on the road. But in some ways, the way I read the book is that he was drinking himself to the point where he just wanted to forget about missing his family and missing home.
Yeah, as one of the record company people who were close to him said, Bonzo was a 25-year-old with the behavior of a 12-year-old. And that's a sad case. You know, he kind of never grew up. He lived by his impulses. And it didn't just hurt him on the road, off, you know, during the hotels and the behavior, but it hurt his performances as well. One of the things I'll tell you, as a musician, when I put the headphones on and listen to this band carefully for the first 50 times, what struck me more than anything was that Bonzo was the premier musician in this band. He played the drums and gave that group a backbeat like I have never heard before. You know, his mentors were people like Buddy Rich and Gene Krupa and some of the great, and Ginger Baker, some of the great drummers. And I really, after listening hard and coming down hard on him, critiquing him, feel that he's in the same category as those drummers. That guy could play like I've never heard before. That said, it hurt him even during performances because he behaved badly on stage, not just, you know, falling asleep on the drums or playing with either a champagne bottle between his legs or a baggie filled with cocaine between his legs. And later on, of course, sadly, heroin. But, you know, he got sloppy when he played Moby Dick, his party piece. It could go on for a half hour to 40 minutes with just him bashing away on the drums. And after a while, it just got tedious. This guy didn't know how to edit himself on stage. And he certainly, unfortunately, didn't know how to edit himself off stage as well.
I found interesting that Zeppelin, for years, did not like the press. But then they were kind of jealous of other bands that were getting more publicity, like the Rolling Stones. It was almost like a, you know, what are we doing? We're outselling their album. Was it Four that outsold Sticky Fingers, like 2-1?
Right.
Yeah. And they weren't getting the publicity. Do you think in the big picture, in their legacy, does Zeppelin now get the credit it deserves? Or is it still in people's mindset a notch below bands like the Beatles and the Stones?
Oh, I think it's a notch below. And part of that has to do with the label heavy metal that was slapped on them. And so, you know, anybody who thinks that they are a connoisseur of the best rock music is almost embarrassed to say that they're a Led Zeppelin fans. But let's get back to their the way they dealt with the press and their fans for a second. You know, I was the Beatles biographer.
Right.
And was very close to Keith Richards for a while. And again, soon. But those bands, they loved connecting with their fans. The Beatles always wanted to, they played to the fans. If they encountered them off stage, they were gracious with them. I had been on New York City streets with Keith Richards when fans walk up to him and go, "Hey, Keith," and he puts his arm around them. He takes picture with them. He takes his skull ring off and puts it on the finger.
Cool.
And if you had tried reaching out to shake the hand of anybody from Led Zeppelin, you might have had your arm broken. These guys were so standoffish. They decided early, we're not going to cater to the fans, that fans were just there to satisfy, to put themselves in the seats and to buy their albums. And very early on, they decided they were not going to cooperate with the press either. And even to the point when there was a press party for Led Zeppelin, for one of their albums, they would be walled off and sitting surrounded by protectors at a table and out of reach of the press. When Jimmy and Robert used to pour over all of the fan magazines and the rock press looking for some mention of them, and when they didn't get it, they were shocked. I mean, this was of their own making. They craved good press, but they didn't know how to deal with the press. And then any of the press that traveled with them on their plane was all bought and paid for. They gave them first class tickets to follow them. They sent hookers to their room. They gave them
that's one way to get a good review, huh?
Yeah, I mean, so, they tried to buy the press in a certain way. And I think that really hurt them as well, because the great press that they did get was not very sincere.
And then they also made the front page in New York when a few dollars were missing from a bank safe. Tell us that story.
Yeah, well, they got paid in cash a lot. and they got paid in cash a lot, because they were in a very high tax bracket in the UK, almost 98%.
Yeah, can you imagine 90 plus percent? Holy heavens.
Right. And so Peter Grant had suitcases with false bottoms on them and would smuggle cash back. And there were many times, and it's throughout the book, you will see Peter with his hold all in a car or on the plane with, $100,000 in $20 and $50 bills. So when they got to New York, I believe it was 75, they stashed the money in a safe deposit box at the hotel they were staying in. And when they came down in the morning, $205,000 was gone. Just their passports remained. The FBI had been on that case for years trying to figure out it out. Five different sources told me that Peter Grant, on his deathbed, had confessed to them that it was an inside job.
Interesting.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
There's gambling going on in this joint? I didn't know that.
In the remaining minutes we have left, it's not a highlight of Zeppelin, but I do want to talk about it because the buildup was so great. I remember I couldn't wait. I heard Zeppelin was going to play Live Aid, and I was working at a grocery store in Winona, Minnesota. And I'm like, I got to get home by whatever it was, 9 o'clock. I think the final hour was broadcast live on ABC. Up to that, it was all on MTV.
Right.
I got home, actually went to a friend's house, I think, where I was staying that weekend. And dang, was I disappointed. What a debacle.
Yeah, from the word go. First of all, they hadn't played together because they didn't have a drummer. They had officially disbanded before then. And so they talked Tony Thompson, one of the great rock drummers, and Phil Collins
in
playing drums together. Now, Phil Collins had appeared at Live Aid in the UK, got on a plane, got on the Concorde, came to Philadelphia to play drums for Led Zeppelin. But he had never rehearsed with them. And he just didn't know the material. Also, Jimmy's guitar was out of tune. Robert threw a fit before him because he didn't want to sing Stairway to Heaven. And Jimmy and he had a huge argument. Robert finally capitulated. The whole vibe was wrong. I mean, Jimmy at one point screamed at someone off stage, "Turn Phil Collins' drums off." And unfortunately for us to have seen this last televised performance of them, it was a sad reunion. I'm sorry that it ended that way for them.
Yeah, there are reunions. I remember talking to Bobby Scafish, a DJ in Chicago, and we were talking about reunion tours. And I think we both agreed that the Eagles put together a pretty good tour, multiple tours, but, you know, starting with Hell Freezes Over. And then we started talking about those that probably should not have happened. And this would have been one of them. However, as you note, they did get back together for another performance. I think it was a salute to Ahmet Erdogan of Atlantic Records. And that was actually a pretty good performance.
Yeah, they had rehearsed quite a bit for that. And Jason Bonham, John's son, played the drums. And so, you know, that was done without it being slapped together, without egos, you know, interfering. And we do have that to say. But I think it's really smart of Robert to have put his foot down and said, not doing it again. John Paul and Jimmy have often tried to get him to come back and do another tour. Ain't ever going to happen.
Good. Good. And you know, it's not because I never saw him. I was too young, but I don't think I'd want to see him today because I'd be worried that it would just be a disappointment. And Robert's doing his own thing and he's doing it well. And so it's, I think it's wise, as you say, wise of him to just say, let's let the past be the past.
You know, we have that great catalog of music that they've left us with, much like the Beatles did at the end of their reign. They left us with this great catalog of music, no downside to it. Time marches on.
So let's get back as we wrap up to the original story about this guy who hitchhiked from New York to Boston. Who is he? Who's our mystery man?
Oh, you want me to do this?
Now I do. Yeah, this, you know, that's, we teased him at the start. Now we got to fulfill the obligation.
Well, I'm going to ruin it for you. I'm going to bury the lead here. But actually, halfway through, he realizes, you know, you can play Train Kept a Rollin'. In fact, you could put some real backbeat to it. It would be really great. He couldn't wait to tell his bandmates about it. And, you know, really, you could change your name, too. I mean, Steven Tallarico, his name didn't really have snap, but Steven Tyler sure did. And so Steven left that, went back and really told his bandmates what he had seen, and the rest is history.
I think you even mentioned in the prologue that he was moved to tears at one point during the Zeppelin performance.
Yeah, he broke down crying. He just couldn't believe what the music did to him. And in fact, Ann and Nancy Wilson had the same reaction as 14-year-old girls when they went to see Led Zeppelin in Seattle. In fact, they had to leave the arena midway through. They were so overcome by it that they had to leave and process it. So very much like Steven did, you know, Led Zeppelin had that effect on their fans. And after doing all this research, after getting to know them for 5 years, after listening to their music, I completely get it.
One other Steven Tyler anecdote that you point out, I think he was actually considered as a possible, I don't want to say fill-in, but that's what he would have been for Robert Plant if the band had kind of picked up the pieces at some point.
Yeah, he actually came in and sang with them, not at an audition, but, you know, it was an audition in Jimmy's mind because Robert wasn't willing to tour with them again. But fortunately, I think for all of us, the whole thing fell apart.
The book is called Led Zeppelin, The Biography. And the author is Bob Spitz. Bob, great to have you on Rock Conversations again. A wonderful conversation and an excellent book.
Rob, always a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much.